mineral out. Really, I said something wrong. It is modestly enriched in this mineral. If we take this mineral out, we increase the concentration of all of the other rare
earths. Give us some summary of the situation in that field.
Let me answer the first question, and then I'll turn to Ed Anders to, as the only man who would likely have read the organic material, for the answer to the second question. The deepest we are going with a core is 10 feet, which hopefully will be collected on Apollo 13. Now, there might be techniques for getting much deeper if we are willing to go into permanently shaded areas and collect material from the side of a cliff. Conceivably, one could get 40, 50, or 100 feet, depending upon how courageous one were and how the operational feasibility turns out on that one.
Yes, probably, as a matter of fact, it will be for the particular things I'm talking about. If Shoemaker's estimate of the depth of the loose layer is correct, then that, in fact, would be sufficient.
By going into
10 meters, the difference between 10 feet, 10 meters, perhaps another factor of three.
But you see, by going into a crater, one side of which is permanently in the shade, I would guess you could have, and doing some trenching and getting material a foot underneath from the successive depths on the cliff there, one could in fact get the kind of material that would be useful to him, extending perhaps to 100, maybe 200 feet. Ed?
In the organic compound area, I think the atmosphere can be described as gloom and doom. Nobody seems to have found anything that's appreciably above background. There are some marginal results, but there is not enough agreement among various investigators that one can say at present whether this is significant or not. The question that may have been in the back of your mind is whether by going deeper one could perhaps tap a sort of primitive carbon compound deposit on the moon. This is the sort of thing that Carl Sagan suggested some years ago. In the light of the age data and the evidence for differentiation, this looks like a less promising possibility than it did a few years ago, because with all the expensive differentiation, it's unlikely that such a primitive layer could have survived. At the same time, we shouldn't completely close the door to it. There is a possibility that the surface layers are severely depleted in organic compounds because of the effects of the solar wind. Hydrogen atoms presumably break down higher molecular weight carbon compounds to some extent. On the other hand, there have been some carbon measurements showing that there are two or possibly three kinds of carbon on the moon. There is indigenous carbon. There appears to be something like solar wind carbon. And there may be a third kind, which is perhaps contamination, perhaps meteoritic or whatever. But unfortunately, most of it is not in form, chemical forms that are interesting to the organic chemist.
Of course, in retrospect, you now know this is a very poor place in which to look for organic compounds because it's a thoroughly baked out piece of the moon. And perhaps the vicinity of these sinuous rills that look as though some watery substance flowed along them would be more promising. If it wasn't water, it was certainly a fluid of some kind. But that will come later.
Be careful there in terms of the very low viscosity of these silicate melts. And it may well be that they've been able to flow large distances on the lunar surface.
Yes.
I think with respect to the organic chemistry, that the very high temperatures that are indicated by the liquid silicate melts that we see on the surface, in a sense, would seem to preclude at least the primary genesis of organic material on the surface. I'd say in terms of the very high temperatures that we see in these silicate melts, I think it would tend to preclude a primary genesis of organic material on the lunar surface. Maybe other members in the panel would like to comment on that.
Maybe you should go on to something else.
Let's catch John Wilson. I have two questions. One for Dr. McGregor. Would you give us the names and spellings of the three minerals? And one general question, is it fair to say from what you have, or to conclude from what you have said, that all the theories about the moon's origin have been found wanting as a result of 11?
Oh, not as a result of 11. Two were wanting long ago. Let's see. There are dynamical arguments against the capture which have existed for many years. It's hard to figure out why the moon is in the orbit it now has, if it were ever once captured. And there are also deductive fundamental arguments of a similar character against straight fission, you know, the daughter torn from the parent planet. I'm a little confused about the outcome of our panel discussion yesterday and what the bearing of the Apollo 11 chemistry is on the third possibility. Maybe Paul Gass or someone else could clarify.
Well, that point. There's a great deal of disagreement about that. I mean, there are obvious differences between the chemistry, the inferred chemistry of the source of the liquids and the composition of the Earth. So a simple-minded soul like myself would say that, you know, the Earth is can't be the moon can't be a part of the Earth. But then you get a very quick response to that and saying, well, maybe something happened to the moon when it came out of the Earth that heated up to very high temperatures that drove out the volatile materials, and that was responsible for these differences in chemistry. There's no answer to that. I mean, maybe it did, and that sort of destroys the argument, or at least makes you sit back and think about whether or not these how valid these arguments are, and sharpen your arguments a little bit as to whether or not you can now reason through this. So that isn't a simple argument. Any difference in chemical composition doesn't automatically mean that the Earth and the Moon, that the Moon couldn't have come out of the Earth, because you can invent a way of producing this chemistry, different chemistry, at the time when you took the Moon out. Then you're back to where you started from. And I think that's where we are right now, if you want to take a poll of different people, and that's why people aren't convinced.
As you have emphasized, it's not just the chemistry. The trouble is, if the moon came off the Earth like mud off a spinning wagon wheel, it would be moving in an orbit that was identical with the equatorial plane of the Earth. Again, it has nothing to do with Apollo 11. It isn't moving in that orbit. The only explanation for that is either that something knocked it out of its orbit, some collision, which is possible. After all, we're dealing with a few bodies, and the statistics are poor. Or, as Littleton has suggested, that Mars came off at the same time. Two fragments of matter came off the Earth. One was Mars, the other was the Moon, and then it's dynamically possible.
I wonder if Ed Anders would like to make a brief comment on this matter.
Well, I probably made the face, whereas nobody else did, and that qualifies me to comment on it. No, I object to this on aesthetic grounds. I'm a simple-minded soul who believes in the simplicity of nature, and when one has a planetary system with regular spacings, it's bad enough when you try to make a special case for the Earth satellites when there are lots of other satellites around in the solar system, and it's worse when you try to get a completely innocent planet some 90 million miles away involved in this complex affair. And I think that somebody should defend the interests of the Martians if they exist.
You know, Ed, I used to think the same, that these very special hypotheses for the Earth-Moon system must be out because there are 32 satellites in the solar system. You don't want a special hypothesis for each of those. But actually, the other satellites are less of a problem. Mars has these tiny droplets of matter around it. It's very likely to have captured them from the asteroidal belt.
Right, but it's so much closer to the source.
Yes.
Or they may be the...
And Jupiter is a very heavy planet, and it has many of its satellites, it and the other giant planets. The satellites are in the equatorial plane. They're also, in any case, again, Jupiter is closer to the asteroidal belt, has a big gravitational field, may have captured its planets. It's only the Earth-Moon system that's a real problem, I think.
Well, I think if you want to postulate that Jupiter captured its satellites, you have to postulate that there were moon-sized bodies around, all of which were then captured by two planets, the Earth and, three planets, the Earth, Jupiter, and Saturn. And there are none of them left. Well, why? And furthermore, capture requires such special conditions, namely a very low approach velocity, which in turn means a very short lifetime. And why should these objects be produced only in the vicinity of planets, or where they can henceforth be captured? I don't think that it is necessary at this point to consider Littleton's theory. It could be put on the shelf, and then when the other three theories are thoroughly refuted by Apollo 11, 12, etc., let's take it off the shelf. But I think we ought to have a moratorium on it.
As the chairman of this group, I would like to exercise my prerogative to turn to some other question, and this seems to be evolving into an argument that has little relevance to our lunar samples work.
Okay, getting back to the moon, has the finding of mica been confirmed, and if so, has this any great significance?
Has the finding of who?
Mica.
To my understanding...
This is Ian McGregor answering.
A mica has been found by Gay at Cambridge, I think this is called. And also another hydrosphering phase, an amphibole, similarly found by Gay at Cambridge. And Gustav Arrhenius at Scripps has found a talc-like mineral. But these are in very, very small abundances. And I don't think that it is perhaps significant in terms of the overall genesis of these rocks. In similarly very, in quotes, dry rocks that we see on Earth, it is not uncommon to see very small amounts of a hydrous phase that may be sort of a small residual material left after the whole rock is essentially completely crystallized. And while I'm talking about, I just mentioned that these are the names of the minerals that we are giving them right now, but that new names are in the process of being given to them. And this is chromium titanium spinel. This is a peculiar chromium titanium spinel.
There's evidence on the isotopic composition of hydrogen and water from lunar rocks that is pertinent. The hydrogen is about 1/25th the deuterium content of terrestrial hydrogen, and this is the sort of the thing that people would have expected for hydrogen from the sun, although even this little residue of deuterium is still questionable. So on that basis alone, one can say that the great majority of the tiny bit of water that's been found in lunar samples seems to be of solar origin, not indigenous.
If I may add another point with respect to water, that the very low oxygen pressures that are indicated by the minerals and the phase assemblages for the minerals that we see in these rocks suggests that water probably would not be stable as a phase in these environments anyway, especially at the temperatures you're considering. So perhaps it doesn't say very much about the original water content of the moon. I think we want to be a little cautious in this area of where we place the significance of the data.
We've heard a lot of discussion about temperatures of differentiation, and they range somewhere around 1100 degrees centigrade. I wonder if someone could give us some ballpark figures on the actual range. We've heard 1140, 1100. I'd like to know at what temperatures the volatiles go off, or the brackets between which they go off, and I'd also like to know what that 1100 immediate range is.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
The temperatures of differentiation have been mentioned, and I'd like to have them refined a little.
The cooling temperatures that have measured have been in the range 1100 to 1200 degrees centigrade. I'm not very familiar with the temperatures of volatilization and evaporation of elements from silicate melts, but my suspicion is that you're going to have to get to temperatures of the order of 1500 to 1600 degrees centigrade, and I think there are other panel members would be more qualified on that.
I'd like to ask a cross question. Mm-hmm. Is that bracketed between 1100 and 1200, or is that a lower limit?
It's bracketed between 1100 and 1200 degrees centigrade.
Good evidence.
These are...
Is that right?
That's
the cooling temperature.
That's
you
the cooling
can't
temperature.
Say that the liquid wasn't much hotter.
No, that's what I meant.
Yeah, all right. These are the temperatures indicated by the cooling of these rocks.
Let me rephrase the statement. What they're saying is that's the temperature at which the rocks freeze, just like water freezes to ice. Similarly, not
so
exactly.
But the different minerals freeze out at, olivine I think freezes out at 1500 or something like that.
No, not in these amounts, but what Gene Simmons said would be correct. The cooling temperatures of these rocks is 1100 to 1200 degrees centigrade. That therefore represents a minimum temperature at which these rocks must have existed.
Everybody agrees on that volatilization temperature?
Well, maybe I can say a few words on it. And if a melt at 1100 degrees were in contact with a hard vacuum, then certainly all the elements that we find to be depleted on the moon would in principle evaporate from the surface. The question is how far down this depletion can go, because once the surface layer is depleted,
the same elements, bismuth and lead, etc., would have to be brought up from underneath. And meanwhile, the melt cools and freezes, so it's not clear how efficient this process would be in a thick lava body. At the surface layer, I can guarantee it should be very efficient.
Ed DeLong, and then we'll take Jim Maloney after that.
A couple of questions to whoever wants to tackle them. Number one, I'd like somebody to go over a little summary of any major theories that have been pretty solidly laid to rest by the Apollo 11 findings, if any. And number two, I wonder if I could get Dr. McGregor, or if Dr. McGregor touched on this initially, wonder if somebody would comment on how much you really think you can learn about the moon as a whole on succeeding flights by looking at just the surface or near surface layers without seismic readings that go all the way through to the core.
I think with respect to the surface layers, that if you're just looking purely at the mineralogy of these rocks, about all you can say is have something about the original history, but you have very little resolution on what has happened to these rocks after they have formed, and certainly have very little resolution on the time when they have formed. One has to get geochemical data to resolve that problem. With respect to the understanding of the interior of the moon and other planets, I think this is an extremely important question. Really, it is only through the understanding of the interior of this planet that we begin to start to understand some of the processes that we see on the surface of the Earth. Certainly in the details of the evolution of the major phenomena that we see on the Earth, perhaps we can talk about the details in the same way we can talk about we pick up a rock from the lunar surface, that this rock is formed from a silicate melt. But this is, in a sense, a relatively small or piece of information when seen in its true perspective. We want to take this and interpret back to get a history out of it. And to do this, we need a much larger understanding of the total problem that we're dealing with. And in this sense, the understanding of the interior of other planets is very, very critical, especially with respect to the density distribution, or heat flow, for example. These things are critical to understanding the history of these planets.
I'd like to amplify this a little bit. I think that you don't have to think very hard or think back very far to realize from very simple facts that the Earth must have a very significant density structure. The rocks at the surface of the Earth have densities of 2.5 to 3. The average density of the Earth is 5.5. So you know something has to happen. And seismology has shown us what's happened. The situation with regard to the moon is very different. The rocks at the surface have a density of about 3.2 to 3.3, those that we've seen. The average density of the moon is also about 3.3, so you don't expect that very much is going to happen. So it's clear right from two simple facts, and to which we could add one more, the moment of inertia, that we should not expect, in the case of the moon, a great deal of internal structure like we have in the case of the Earth. What there is from these facts, probably going to be a lot harder to find. That's something I'm going to say about the density structure. Next, about the chemistry, I mean, it's very, what we know about the detailed chemistry of the interior of the Earth does not come from seismology. I mean, every seismologist will agree that the best they can do is tell you something perhaps about the iron content of the interior. They're certainly not going to tell you anything about trace element contents of the interior. If we can establish that a liquid comes from the deep interior, such as 200 kilometers down on the moon, once you accept that or have proved that, then you have a very powerful way of learning something about the internal chemistry. You have one technique, such as that used by Professor Ringwood, who talked yesterday, or Professor O'Hara from Edinburgh, and people like Dr. McGregor, who work in his field, who take a liquid of this observed composition, take it into the laboratory, heat it up at certain, to various pressures and temperatures, or particularly different pressures, and find out what kind of minerals can
grow from that liquid or can be in equilibrium with that liquid, you say. If then you can infer that if that liquid came from the interior, that something about the mineral composition of the interior. Once we know something about how much melting took place in the interior and how elements distribute themselves between the liquid and between the solid that they're in contact with, you can infer from the composition of the liquid what the uranium concentration might be, what the potassium concentration would be. There have been some very preliminary rough estimates of that made with many assumptions along the chain, which suggest that the uranium content of the interior of the moon is not unusually high and that the potassium content is unusually low. But I remind you that there are a lot of assumptions in this chain. But with regard to detailed chemistry, this is a route that's very useful in finding out something like
that. Apropos your statement, I think it's interesting to remark that in this conference that the people who were involved with the experimental work on trying to understand the melting phenomena of rocks of lunar composition at high pressures, that all the people who did this work seemed to come up with the interpretation that if these magmas had come from the lunar interior, they probably must have come from somewhere in the depth range from 200 to 400 kilometers. And three different
They made that as an assumption, though.
Assuming that if these magmas came from the lunar interior, that certainly is the basis.
You assume that because that's the shallowest depth where you can get to the melting point.
Also the chemistry of the magmas.
There was a second question.
Okay.
Second part to this question, which my theories have been laid to rest. I've been thinking about this during this discussion, and I guess I concluded that one is almost certain that the moon is not made of green cheese.
There's two more sentences on this point, on limited sampling by landing in one area. I think we are getting a fairly good assortment of rocks from other surface layers up to some hundreds of miles away, because apparently even some highland material has found its way to Tranquility Base. But we are not getting good samples from depth. I doubt very much if any of the Apollo 11 or 12 rocks come from as deep as a mile down. And if you look at the biggest craters of the moon, they don't go very much farther than a few miles. So if we want to learn something about the internal structure of the moon, as the Professor Gass said, it is difficult to get that from seismic data. One will really have to go to a theoretical treatment of the sort developed by Professor Gass in one of his papers and try to deduce from the composition of the surface layers what other material must be associated with it in order to get this composition. What must be hiding in the moon's interior?
Jim Maloney, and then we'll go to Leo Janis.
I've got questions for two of the panel members. First, Dr. Jastrow, how do you know that the highland areas are older than the Maury? And second, how much older would they be? And then for Dr. Anders, you very briefly mentioned an E-type rock. Could you describe that to us and tell us about what happened to C and D, too?
The Mare material laps up against the shores of the highlands almost as if it were really water. And it's very clear, just by inspection of lunar orbital photographs, that this Mare material was laid down, that it filled basins, natural depressions, in what must have been originally an earlier existing highland terrain. Now, how much older it is, we don't know. If it turns out that the Mare dust in Tranquility is 4.66 billion years old, then the highlands can't be very much older than that, we presume. Or at least that would be a great surprise if they were. Perhaps 50 million years older, or 10, or 100 million. I don't know.
Well, my part of the question. A and B are crystalline rocks, as named by the preliminary examination team, fine grains and coarse grains. C is a breccia apparently made up of the soil, which was called D. So the next available letter is E, and we have inferred that one part of the jigsaw puzzle is missing, and I've tentatively named it E. You want to comment on it?
No, I didn't realize that. It's a good thing.
Do we start with the rest of the alphabet now in the Apollo 12 rock?
Greek alphabet, too.
Would you anticipate that the findings of 11 and on succeeding missions on materials from the near side of the moon would also be relevant to what might be on the far side of the moon? Or to put it another way, can we really have a complete picture of the nature of the moon and perhaps a trace back to the origins of the universe, unless someday there are explorations to the far side of the moon.
Go ahead.
Very difficult to answer that question. We have very little information. I think the only thing we do know is that the lunar highlands do look more like the backside than any other part of the moon. And perhaps the landers in the highlands will give us some resolution to that problem. I don't know how else to answer this.
One way of answering that, you could ask the same thing about the Earth. Supposing we could only study one continent, what could we infer about the other continents? Well, if we know the data, I mean, we would have inferred correctly from one continent to the other on Earth. And I think from what you know about the morphology of the backside of the moon, it's unlikely that Shelkovsky, which is a sort of small filled basin, is very different from an equivalent thing on the front side in major features. I mean, there will be minor features.
What about the overdormance and that sort of thing? Would there be any difference in the kinds of the intensities of bombardments from the sun, from the far side to the near sun?
Yes, there would indeed. And in fact, various people have made the suggestion to test various models to explain certain anomalies in argon 40 and whatnot, that the really crucial test is to go to the poles and to the backside of the moon and so forth. So, indeed.
Why is the far side bombarded in a different way by the sun than the near side?
Because of the solar wind coming in a direct line, it doesn't come in quite. And
why don't you talk to the microphone? They might like to hear it. Like that's very confusing.
Well, you would expect,
since both sides are exposed to the sun, it was a very simple-minded question.
I don't know the answer to it. Right? I have to think about it.
Okay.
We're going to have to close it with a final question from Mark Bloom.
All right. Well, I have two questions. One is a follow-up to the other one. I'd just like to ask Gene Simmons if he has been pushing the people in MSC to put a communication satellite or two around the moon so we can go to the back of the moon.
The answer to the straightforward answer to your question is no, I have not yet started pushing, and I don't mean to imply that I am going to start pushing. I think it's worth exploring this matter of putting up a communication satellite. It's also worth exploring the question of could we possibly land on the backside without a communication satellite. I personally think that it would be desirable to land on the backside of the moon. Maybe that's a hunch on my part. But the very real practical side of this matter is that a communication satellite is not inexpensive. And in the present framework, I'm not sure that any of these people on this panel would be ready to sacrifice one or two of their few remaining missions, at least as announced, in return for a satellite that would permit them to use still another of their remaining missions to go to the backside. Still a fairly expensive thing, and without knowing what the costs are involved, what I'm saying is I think given a certain number of dollars, one has to be very cautious in saying, yeah, we'd like to have a communication satellite, because they do eat up dollars.
It's probably be about $30 million, but let me go on to the other question, which is more important, I think, in this area. Is Paul Gass timescale took us down to zero. Is there anything from Apollo 11 which would indicate that the moon's history that what has caused the formation of the face of the moon and so forth does not extend all the way down close to zero?
It's I'll try and answer that. I think that what you're asking for, are there any rocks that have essentially thrown on the surface yesterday, like this. The only chance that to get an Apollo 11 to find something that would yield a number with the dimensions of time that's very low is bring something to the surface yesterday.
And I think that the youngest cosmic ray exposure ages are in the tens of millions of years, which is relatively young geologically. But I think Bob Walker could say something about the fact that there are continually new surfaces being created on the surface because of the erosion of the material.
Well, what I meant was, was there anything from Apollo 11 which ruled out the fact that, perhaps 50 million years ago, some other part of the moon
might not have done something?
In other words, it's been pretty dead since 2.7.
That's my conviction, yes. 2 billion years ago, it's continually decreasing in activity.
I'm sorry, we discussed this with Gene Shoemaker last night. He was in the room a little while ago. He left early. And he pointed out there were some areas on the lunar seas which were considerably less thickly cratered than the Sea of Tranquility, something like one-fifth. And if you assume that the crater density method is reasonably good for age determinations, that would imply that the youngest and least cratered surfaces might be less than 1 billion years old.
Yeah, well, it's better to say there's a very low level of activity, but it may have continued throughout
history.
Right.
Yeah.
At a low level.
The probability of finding young material goes down the younger you get.
Yeah.
The probability of finding something that was formed goes down the younger you get.
Thank you very much. I do understand there's a news release now in the newsroom announcing Neil Myers is the new associate administrator for manned spaceflight.
Because the drill is built to go 10 feet.
It might be just a local volcanic eruption.
The main motivation for the drill was to get...